From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This week on the show, we're going to dig into yet another way Facebook gets data about you and the surprising places all that data is coming from. Later on, I'll be chatting with Qualcomm President Cristiano Amon, for whom I really only had one question, which is, what is 5G actually, and why should anyone care? I guess that's two questions, but we'll get to that later. First up, after last week's Samsung event, this past week in Barcelona was the Mobile World Congress, a huge showcase on the future of phones. And more so than a lot of recent years, there's actually a lot from MWC to talk about. So here with me, as always, Joanna Stern in New York and Christopher Mims in Baltimore. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
Mims, are you in the attic?
As always, as ever.
This is boring. We're going to have to stop asking you. Just start lying. Just come up with like increasingly elaborate lies. And
I think
we'll
you
never
just need to start asking me a more interesting question, David.
Like,
no, I only care about your physical location. Nothing else about
what
you.
Am I,
what are you wearing?
What am I drinking today?
What are you wearing?
Tantric turmeric kombucha. It tastes like sweaty hippies. It's awesome.
Wow. Hmm. I'm drinking a Starbucks iced coffee, which took me 35 minutes to get because a woman in line in front of me ordered 24 drinks and just absolutely ground Starbucks to a halt. And it was absolutely infuriating at like 8:45 in the morning. And everyone was so angry in this Starbucks. It was very funny. But anyway, okay, so let's talk about MWC. Here's how this segment is going to work. So I think of it, it's like gadget show and tell, except this is just a podcast. So it's gadget tell. I don't know. Basically, we each picked our favorite thing from MWC, which can be the weirdest thing or coolest thing or dumbest thing, whatever you guys want to do. But you have to tell us what it is and explain why you picked it. Joanna, you get to go first.
So it will not come as a surprise to you that I picked the ugliest phone, but it is the most practical phone. It has an 18,000 milliamp battery inside it. And this is a phone that's made by Energizer. And just close your eyes, everyone, and picture an iPhone but stacked like four times. That's how thick this phone is because the battery is so big.
Wait, so put in context,
is
how big is an 18,000
really
milliamp hour battery?
Happy about that? So an iPhone currently has around 3,000 milliamps, depending on the model. Like the iPhone XS has a 2,600 milliamp battery. It looks like just like a regular Android phone with just this giant back.
Yeah, but we call big Android phones bricks when they're like particularly large. This one is actually size of a brick.
You could build a house with these. Yeah, so the company promises 48 hours of continuous video playback. So the screen can be on for 48 hours nonstop streaming video.
Why even quote that statistic? Like, is that for torturing somebody? You hold their eyes open and make them vet Facebook content or something?
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about what the practical uses
phone.
Of this. Yeah, I mean, look, I don't really need this phone. I do really want it, though, because it just is like, it feels like it stands against everything that's happened in the mobile phone industry, which is, let's make everything thinner and slimmer so we can cut cheese with this thing and do really crazy thin things with it, where like no one was really asking for that. Like phones, even, you know, 2 years ago were a decent thinness. On the other hand, like I have the iPhone XR, and as I've said on this podcast and have said many, many times, is the best battery life I've had ever on an iPhone. I love this phone. I can get through the day and even a little bit more with the battery. So I don't really need a phone that big with that big of a battery, but it just feels like the future.
I do like that Energizer, obviously a battery company, is going to be the one to come out with a phone with a lot of battery. But instead of saying, you know, here's 2 days of battery life or 3 days of battery life, they're like, we're going all the way after this. The most battery life you've ever seen in your life. Our phone weighs 60 pounds and it lasts forever.
I wonder how much it does weigh.
It's the seven blade option. It's like, well, let's just go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is a French company licensing the Energizer brand.
Yeah.
So it
doesn't.
True.
Yeah, Mims does this, some real reporting on the phone. I mean, I just looked at the pictures, really. That's
okay.
My pick.
Mims, what's yours?
Let me just say, I predicted 100% that was going to be your pick, Joanna. So
yeah, I think we all saw that coming.
No, guys.
Everybody knows about the folding phone, so I can't talk about the folding phone. My pick is actually the new Nokia slide-out banana phone, which was made famous in The Matrix. So number one, what's great about it is it costs $100. And yet it has a lot of the stuff we want, like maps, social media apps, stuff like this. and the battery lasts a long time. Number two, a lot of people lately have been looking at the absurd state of the world and saying, this is definitely a simulation. And I feel like bringing back a phone that was made famous in The Matrix proves that. So not to get too meta on you guys, but yeah. So I just feel like if you own this phone, you know, Agent Smith will come into your life and you will wake up from the horror that's the present.
What is the name of this phone?
It's the Nokia and then four digits.
It sounds like every Nokia phone. I love it. It's just like a bunch of Nokia numbers.
It's just the Nokia candy bar phone
Is it the Nokia
keyboard.
One Plus?
I remember loving this phone. It's the one that like Neo's in the Matrix and he opens it up and he calls Trinity and he's like, get me out. And then that's how he gets it. And
so
it's like the coolest moment ever. Yeah.
I see.
And this phone was a real thing that existed.
Yeah, yeah.
A
my dad had
ago.
This phone.
Yeah. And I think. Yeah, I'm fascinated by this thing of people who have smartphones wanting some smart things but not a smartphone. And this feels like one of the coolest versions of that.
This does look really nice.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, why do we not give up our smartphones? It's because, well, you know, you really do need maps and stuff. But do we want all the other gewgaws, you know? Maybe not, especially if it's $100. I'm all about purpose-built devices.
Totally. And I like the idea of having, I'm increasingly into the theory of like having a weekend phone where I'm like, this is my phone I use during the work week. And then I take my SIM card out and I put it in something different. And I just use that for the weekend. And
you know
something
better
like this
than a weekend
is
phone?
Perfect for that. Just a...
A weekend house. Deep
with
insights
no phones.
Here.
Spoken like a true millennial. If you just cut out enough smartphones and avocado toast, you would have that.
So, David, what is your pick?
So, my pick is the LG G8. So, LG makes very good phones that absolutely nobody cares about because they're just the same as Samsung's, but worse, generally. And nobody cares. But LG has, as a way of trying to solve this, gotten increasingly weird with its ideas about what phones can be. And the G8, in addition to having, you know, a million cameras like all the other phones and having a great screen like all the other phones, it has a front-facing sensor set similar to the one that you'd find on like an iPhone, or do you remember that big Project Tango phone that Google had a couple of years ago that you could do AR stuff with? It has that same sensor array, and they're using it to give you this gesture control on your phone. So you hold your hand over your phone and it registers that your hand is there, and then you do this weird sort of hand bunching thing. They imagine it like you're grabbing a computer mouse. So you like bunch your hand up, and then if you move to the left, you can open an app or pause your music or whatever, all without touching your phone.
Didn't Samsung
I used this. Yes. So Samsung did this a few years ago and it didn't work, and LG is doing it now and it still doesn't work. It's you have to be in this like very specific area. You have to do it just right. Everything has to be just very correct and accurate, and it takes 100 times longer than just touching your phone. But I kind of love that LG is trying this because A, I think there is some world in which we're going to want another way to interact with screens, and I think gestures are like a really interesting one, so I'm always a fan of people trying. And B, I am just so excited about the day that I see someone in the wild holding their phone in one hand and like doing what looks like sort of magic spells at it with the other hand. And I'm so happy that this exists and is a phone that people are going to actually spend money on.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're like, we can't wait for people to look like total idiots.
Yeah. But like in general, touch is great. Voice is great. And that we're going to need some sort of third thing. And I think it might be sort of gestures in some way. But this is not the answer.
I want to change my pick from a World Congress, and I don't even know the instructions that we had to choose a phone.
No, you could choose anything.
Okay, so the HoloLens 2.
Ooh, okay.
Actually is my pick now. Sorry, Energizer, whoever makes that phone. Because Microsoft announced the HoloLens 2 at Mobile World Congress, and people are like, why did they announce this thing here? It's not really a phone. There's no really mobile announcement. They're not even going to really offer this to consumers. It's just direct to enterprise. It's still like $3,000. But they made like everything that was really bad about the first HoloLens a lot better in
the
second
one. Can you explain
one.
What HoloLens is really quick, just for anybody who doesn't like follow the boring AR news of the world?
So HoloLens was a augmented reality, mixed reality headset that Microsoft announced almost like 5 years ago, 4 years ago now.
Yeah, it's been a while.
And it is a very heavy set of glasses that you put on your face and you can see quote unquote holograms in front of you. I'm not really sure that's quite yet what you're seeing there, but you see projected images in your real space. And There were some really big issues with the first one. One being that it was like, anytime I've written about it, I've just like crushed them for how uncomfortable this thing was. Like my ears would just, anytime I'd wear it, my ears would just be crushed. I'd take it off and I'd have just like a giant thing across my face, like worse than scuba mask. So they made it more comfortable. They said, I haven't tried it out yet. They made the field of view better. So you can see holograms sort of out of your peripheral vision, they're saying, or a little bit more than where it used to be. So that's better. And they've also improved gestures. And so that made me think of what you were saying, David, which is like, maybe that's really where we're going to use our hands and wave weird things in the air. And even like, you know, eye tracking is in this space where we're not going to be holding a screen. And so they've made that built in better, so you can navigate the menus better, apparently, with it. And you can look in different directions and move things around with your hands.
I like it. I do like that Microsoft is making this technology sort of in the public, but not saying it's for regular people yet. They're like objectively not trying to sell this to consumers. They're like, this is cool. It's getting better. Normal humans should not buy this yet. This is for sort of a specific purpose, which I think is exactly the right way to go about this.
I also tweeted, I'm trying to find my tweet.
I think Joanna reads her own tweets should be a recurring segment on this show. I kind of like this.
This is good. Because I don't write anymore. I just put my stuff in tweets. I said, this is the ugliest, most exciting, most innovative thing in tech right now. And then Microsoft, Frank Shaw of Microsoft PR just wrote back, it isn't ugly, Joanna. And it is, though, Frank.
So last week, the Journal published a big investigation into yet another way Facebook is collecting data on its users. But for this one, you don't actually even have to be using Facebook, and it's data you might not expect to end up on Facebook. So our reporters found that at least 11 popular apps were sharing incredibly sensitive data like pregnancy information and your heart rate without Facebook telling you and without you knowing that this was happening. You give an app your data and it gives that app to Facebook. It's scary stuff. So there's a lot going on here. So to help us dissect it, we're going to call Sam Schechner, one of our reporters on the story, at his home in Paris. Apparently, Sam is putting his kids to bed right about now. So hopefully we can time this right. Let's see if we can get him.
Hello.
Sam, thank you for being here. I'm sorry it's so late in Paris while we're doing this.
It's fine. Not actually that late.
Good. Okay, so let's back up a little. I want to sort of start at the beginning of this story, because one of the things that interested me in reading this big investigation that we just published is how you got wind in the first place of what Facebook is doing and how it's getting data from these apps that people are using. Because I feel like so much of what we've learned about data sharing and where your private information is going is so opaque and complicated that it can be hard to figure out even where to start. So like, how did this story come about?
Well, this is months ago now, we were trying to figure out, you know, what we could do to look at this broader ecosystem. It didn't start out as a Facebook project. We wanted to look at where apps were sending data. I had this idea, not my idea, from reading lots of smart people, that, you know, there were a lot of third-party SDKs built into all of the apps that we use. And so we were curious, you know, which ones were getting what kinds of data and what they were doing with it. That's when we set about to try to start testing apps, you know, simple proxy server, really, in our own network, and started lists of all the different places that each app contacted. And that's when we started noticing the traffic to Facebook.
Okay, so two things in there I actually want to tease out. So this SDK thing that you're talking about ends up figuring sort of prominently in the story, but I feel like it's sort of a complicated techie thing that not a lot of people understand. Can you explain like what an SDK is and how it ends up in an app you might be using, even if you don't necessarily know about it?
Well, developers, you know, want to build all kinds of functionality into their app. So let's say I want to, you know, have something that will help me navigate my users around my store. I don't know how to do anything with geolocation or, you know, Bluetooth beacons or whatever you might do to guide people around my store. So I go to some company that makes a geolocation software development kit, and that's what SDK stands for. And either some of them make them for free, maybe in return for my data. Some of them charge money. So let's say I buy one, you know, and I pay a license fee, and then I integrate their code, that SDK, into my app. And apps will have you know, anywhere from 19 to 30 different SDKs built into them. It's totally possible to code it all yourself, but it's just a feature of the modern world that a lot of developers say, oh, well, I'll just get the best analytics tool from over here. And I want to integrate, you know, Google's ads into my app. And I want Facebook's ads too. So, oh, and I want Facebook's login and Twitter's login. And so you integrate all these SDKs into your app. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that the SDKs, there's nothing really to stop the SDKs from having access to the same information that the app has access to. They're just part of the app. It's as if I had a bionic arm. I mean, it becomes part of my body.
So, and then the like second order result of that is then that if I'm sharing data with this app through an SDK that Facebook in this case or anyone else creates, that in theory, Facebook or whoever else can also access that data because I'm essentially giving this data to them through this app, right? I feel like that's really opaque to users, but is that essentially how it works?
Yeah, it is. I mean, at some level, it's up to the developer of the app and how they implement the SDK and how tech savvy they are. They may not really realize what they're asking the app to do, or in many cases, they're explicitly telling the SDK to do that. In the case of the Facebook SDK, there's a lot of different functions in there. You know, you can use the Facebook SDK to do logins. You can have them do Facebook advertisements in your app, and they'll pay you money. And you can also use them for analytics. And that's actually the tool that came up in our reporting. Essentially, you would actually explicitly tell Facebook, log everything that the users do in my app. And then afterwards, I can go look at a fancy dashboard and it'll tell me, gee, people are only using my app for 5 minutes. And after they get to the sign up screen, they all leave. And that might be useful information for you to, you know, redesign your app. And there's a lot of kind of standard events, they call this app events, that the SDK will capture like that. And then you can also build in custom ones because apps are all different. And that's where we started to get to the really gnarly, sensitive data that was being sent. These health and fitness apps in particular were setting up custom app events and sending them to Facebook that included things like your weight, when you're having your period, what your blood pressure is, you know, the calorie content of the last meal you had, and having Facebook log that data for them.
And it doesn't even matter if you had a Facebook account, right? Like, presumably these app companies or these app makers were using Facebook's backend tools for various other things, and they didn't even necessarily care if they were trying to find their users on Facebook, right?
Exactly. I mean, the added advantage if you were a Facebook user is that these apps could then say, okay, I want to buy an ad for, you know, everybody who is ovulating today. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We have no proof that they did that, although I did sign up for a few apps as a making myself somewhat shorter and fatter than I actually am. And I got a Facebook ad encouraging me to exercise once with a silhouette of a very short, fat person. So, you know, I think that some of them might be using this data to target ads on Facebook. But if you are not a user, that data still turns up in the stats on Facebook that the apps have access to.
And so we have this story our colleague Katie Binley wrote about basically even if you disable all this stuff on Facebook, like it's basically still going to track you. I mean, that's the top line summary is like there's no way to get away from Facebook. I've been sort of thinking even if I leave Facebook, I don't get away from them. It seems like your story kind of also supports that.
I think that's true. You know, what is still opaque to a lot of people is, you know, what they actually do with the data for non-users. Mm-hmm. I mean, Facebook says, and they've been asked, you know, 8 different ways by 12 different, you know, legislatures, practically. What do you do? Do you have shadow profiles? Mm-hmm. And they basically say that they use the data for non-users to either A, provide these analytics for apps, you know, just for the users of that app, or for security purposes to make sure that, you know, it's not a bot. Or, you know, to show them just kind of untargeted Facebook house ads or other untargeted ads based on context, but not, you know, building a behavioral profile. But, you know, it's kind of hard to prove that that's the case. And in any case, there are definitely other outfits that have their SDKs built into apps that don't have that kind of rule. I mean, they're not even a social network for you to be a member of in the first place, and mm-hmm. they're certainly tracking you, and they're built into all sorts of apps. And, you know, even if you aren't sharing your advertiser ID, some of them somewhat illegitimately get other ways of fingerprinting your device. So you can be tracked you know, even if you're super trying to be super careful about it.
What I had trouble with reading the story was figuring out how much this is the system working the way it's supposed to versus somebody breaching the system. Like, you have this sort of semi-outraged response from Facebook saying, this is not how this is supposed to be. And then you have a bunch of the companies saying, well, yeah, I guess we do that. It's probably fine. And then a bunch have changed their policies. And then it seems like I couldn't get a handle on to what extent this was sort of somebody abusing the system or if this is just using the system the way that it was designed. What's your sense of that?
I mean, I think that's a super good point, you know, because in fact, it's a little bit of both. And that's the tension, right? I mean, Facebook, one of Facebook's responses is, listen, this is standard industry procedure to share this data. And to an extent, that's true. That raises the question of, well, should it be?
Can you guys just imagine if when The Jungle came out, the response was like, well, but everybody grinds this into their sausage.
Right.
Well, so, I mean, I do think that the point you're making, David, is a really good one, that at one level, this is how the ecosystem works. And there's a fair amount of data that's shared that probably doesn't rise to the level of the bar we set in the story, which is actively sending along manually inputted information or manually recorded information that would qualify as sensitive health or financial information. There's plenty of apps that are sending information that doesn't hit that bar that would still probably, you know, creep some people out.
I get this overwhelming sense that either truly nobody understands kind of the entirety of this system, like where your data comes from, how it's collected, how it's used, where the ad comes from, or they've just gotten really, really good at obfuscating and lying to us about it. And ultimately, I feel like this stuff becomes a much bigger deal when it stops being about ads. Joanna, you and I were talking about this earlier, that ultimately, if the worst thing that comes out of this is really targeted ads, that's different. But there are going to be other things that happen with this data. Do you have any better sense of whether you or anyone understands kind of the full picture of how your data moves around? Or is it just as complicated as these companies want to lead us to believe?
I think a lot of people have a, you know, somewhat of a picture, but no, it is too big an ecosystem. There's too many players. There's literally hundreds of companies that might touch data here or there, and they all might do different things with it. It's possible to do a trick like we did. There definitely are a lot of other potential uses. And that's before you start to think about how some of this data might be used to train AI that will start making decisions about the kind of content we see or the kind of insurance we get or the kind of medical care we receive.
I actually appreciate the targeted ads. Like, I can't say, like, you know, if I was pregnant, I'd be really happy to get a, you know, ad right away because you're in really sensitive state at that point, right? But, and there are certain points where you may not want to get ads for certain types of things. But overwhelmingly, I'm like, oh, that's great that I got an ad after I watched that thing because now I might want to buy that thing. I mean, I don't think it's great, but I don't mind it, right? And it's not till you start to think about, okay, where is the data? Who could get the data and use it in nefarious ways? Do I actually care about us not having any control?
I still want to know why.
I mean,
that sort of gets to
Katie's
story. Like, how did they figure out that I'm the one for this ad? And so, you know, yeah. Facebook, to their credit, has this, you know, why am I seeing this ad button? And you click on it and the answers are deeply unsatisfying and almost implausible.
Right.
You know, I'll get, you know, I started running. And so I start to get all these running ads. And clearly, they're, you know, somebody is tracking that I've downloaded these apps and are using them.
Right.
Like,
I mean,
and using them. And the answer for why do you see this ad will be like, we're targeting, you know, people between 18 and 55 living in France.
Totally.
And it's like, well.
And I think that's what I mean by like the innocent one mentioned, like thing I mentioned, which is like, I watch Baby Shark on YouTube all the time, right? I love it personally. I just
like
love
us
it.
All.
Like us all. I get ads all the time for Baby Shark stuff. And I bought a bunch of Baby Shark t-shirts for my family, which was like the greatest moment in my life probably in, well, ever, yeah. And we all wore the t-shirts, right? And like, okay, I can think of that as like, I got this ad. It was actually really beneficial for a thing that I wanted, and that's great. Right. But I knew that it was because I watched Baby Shark 100 million times and my family's responsible for the billions of views of Baby Shark on YouTube. That's why I got that ad. Right. You're totally right. It's the transparency for the many other ads that we get where we're not really sure anymore. Right. Like it's the creepiness of like that. Did I just say that? Like, is it listening? And that was the piece I wrote last year that we think Facebook's listening because they've gotten so much data about us. It's basically like they are. I just wanted to talk about Baby Shark.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys caught the Vanity Fair profile of Facebook's internal almost judicial body, which decides what is hate speech or not. I wonder if part of the problem here is that Facebook has done a bad job of explaining how Facebook works. Like, I think 3/4 of Americans don't understand still that their feed is sorted. So try explaining to everybody that the nature of big data and AI is that with a handful of data points, I can predict who you are and what you like so well that you can go and have a conversation about a mattress and I will advertise it to you within a week. Not because we're listening, but because that's how predictable we are. So I think Facebook's defense here, which it has some validity to it, is that they are getting past this data. Facebook doesn't necessarily know what this data means, and they're just feeding it into this AI algorithm. And it's not that they're listening through our microphones. It's that with a handful of data points, we really are that predictable. So you talk about a particular mattress and a week later you get advertised that mattress. It really is because it is very likely that people in your demographic who live where you are, who have, you know, 6 other characteristics that nail them down, are thinking about or talking about that mattress. And that, I think, is kind of a mind-blowing fact, and it is essential to Facebook's creepiness of its ad targeting. And I think if Facebook could do a better job of explaining, at least to journalists, that this is what's going on, maybe it would help. I think that the other challenge, though, is that they've just lost enough trust that the whole, you know, just trust us. Like, if even though there is a hypothetical world, which I think we do live in, where Facebook is really not examining our data and spying on us in any sense that's meaningful, the fact that they have, you know, leaked data in the past makes that argument sort of invalid for most people.
Yeah. Sam, you've gotten a lot of feedback on this piece too, and a lot of things have sort of set in motion and started to change. Like, have you seen anything that seems like a sort of a significant departure from the way that things were before, either from Facebook learning how to talk about this stuff or others?
Well, I certainly got a lot of reader feedback with people saying, oh no, Facebook is definitely listening to my microphone. That was about half of the reader feedback I got.
I still get that email from the piece I wrote a year ago.
Well, I keep sending them your story. I mean, I was like talking people off the ledge. You know, I don't actually know that it's not true, but I tend to think that there's probably more efficient ways for them to make these guesses. But I mean, people were telling me very bizarre stories about, you know,
I got the
financial
I got the weirdest stories too. Like, people were going out to a field and talking about things, and they were making sure there were no microphones around, but then they would still get the ad. Like, the most bizarre stories.
Yeah, Facebook is bugging the cornfields now.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, coming up in just a second is my interview with Cristiano Amon, the president of chip-making giant Qualcomm, all about what 5G might actually mean for you, a regular human. But first, I have a question for you two, Joanna and Christopher. Do either of you have your cell carrier's app on your phone, my Verizon or my AT&T or whatever? Do you guys use those?
I do.
I've got a work phone. It doesn't have that app on it.
Okay. So I ask because I wrote this story about Google Fi last week and basically investigated, like, is this a great new wireless carrier? And their whole thing is, we have this great app you can use to manage your account, and it's way more transparent, and there's a lot more you can do just from this instead of having to deal with customer service. And in the course of reporting it, I discovered that, like, all of these carriers now have these apps that are actually really useful. I don't know if you use the one that you have, Joanna, but
I do.
The My Verizon app that I have is so good.
This is just proof that you've never read anything I've written on carriers in the last 5 years.
That's absolutely correct.
But that's okay. That's okay.
Because you've been writing about this? What did I miss?
Just that every time I'm like, I always bash on the carriers, and anytime I just try to throw them a bone, which is true, which is use your carrier's app if you want to know more about what the carrier's doing with your billing and your data and all these little line items that cost you an extra $50 a year, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, it's all still nonsense, but it is by far the most transparent and useful way to actually deal with Verizon that I've ever discovered. And they have like a loyalty program that only works in the My Verizon app. It's all very strange. But
yeah. Oh, no, they're still like robbing you, but it is good to use the app.
But at least they're robbing you to your face if you're looking at it in the app.
That's how I cover the carriers. I'm like, they are robbing you, but here are some things that they do give you to make it nicer when they do rob you.
Yeah. So at least, you know, make it feel a little bit better. And my tip for the week definitely get that app for whatever carrier you have and figure out exactly how you're being robbed.
And you can, okay. You know what? I'm in the Verizon app right now, and I'm going to gift you a 1 gigabyte of data, David. That's one thing you can do in the Verizon app. You guys can
honestly,
if you like this podcast, gift us data.
I genuinely mean this. I think that's the nicest thing you've ever done for me, Diana.
Wow, this feels like a new form of graft. What happens if I gift you guys data? That just goes
don't actually don't gift me data because I already pay for unlimited data and I don't need your data. Give gift the data to someone who's in need.
You know what? Every week we should pick a reader's email, gift them data.
Yeah, like thanks for writing to us. Here's 1 gig of data.
Here's a gig of data.
All right, David, I'm sending it to you right now.
Thank you.
I can add a personal touch message.
Aw. Okay. Well, while you do that. Coming up in just a second, I ask Cristiano Amon, the president of Qualcomm, to explain once and for all what the heck 5G actually is.
It's Wi-Fi.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older, they're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Welcome back. This week at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, everybody was talking about 5G. There were 5G phones and 5G networks, just 5G everything. But here's the thing about 5G. It's mostly becoming this meaningless, nonsensical term that describes very fast internet. Or, on the flip side, you ask somebody about 5G and they really want to tell you about millimeter wave technology and virtual operators and a bunch of other stuff that nobody cares about. So what really matters about 5G is, when should I get a phone that supports it? What will it do for me? Is it going to absolutely nuke my batteries? So I sat down with Cristiano Amon right after last week's Samsung event and asked him to answer as many of those questions as I could, as practically as possible. Starting with, what is 5G going to do for me? The first thing he said was, it'll actually work everywhere, all the time, and that'll change everything.
You can have the reliability of 99.9999%. That allows you to replace industrial Ethernet cables, allow you to do remote surgeries, allow you to connect mission-critical computers, allow you to connect manufacturing robots, and everything. So what it does is now you have a flexible technology that allows you to do high speeds, low speeds, guarantee of service. And with that, it becomes economical now for you to replace everything out there because the scale of mobile is huge. There's nothing that has the biggest scale right now as mobile. There are more smartphones than toothbrushes, as an example.
Is that true?
It is true.
That's frightening. I don't know what that says about toothbrushes, but that's a crazy number. Okay, so the reliability piece of it, I think, is really interesting because I think we are tolerant and sort of expecting of a certain amount of failure on the part of wireless, right? Like when you go into, I don't know, a subway and the internet doesn't work, like people aren't surprised. For all these things you're describing, like that's not allowed. Like we're going to have to get to a point where things are just never fail. And I feel like with wireless, we've been promised versions of that for a long time, but it's never been anywhere close to that. Like, are we really going to get there?
I love this question. Actually, that's actually the great question to ask about 5G. And let me answer this question by giving you a number of examples. When you look at a 4G smartphone, even if you have a bad signal, in most cases, you'll be able to stream music. That's why people don't download music anymore. They stream it. They Spotify, other services. With 5G, that's how you're going to feel about 4K video. No matter what signal you have, you're going to have enough speed to be able to have 4K video. And then it's going to be the main platform for distribution of video. Even like sports and live news, people will be able to see on their 5G phone. Now, the next step is the most important one. 5G is about connecting you with the cloud. And as you build coverage, you're going to have the speed and the reliability. They're all going to be connected with the cloud 100% of the time. And people are going to live much more on the app than the OS. The OS may not matter anymore because everything is going to be connected. Your data, you're not going to be thinking about what data to put in your phone. You're going to put it in the cloud because you are connected. And it's been designed as such so that our experience as a user, we're not going to see anymore a scenario that you just don't have connectivity. You just can assume it's there and it's going to work like electricity.
So the whole notion of being offline is just going to disappear?
As coverage gets mature, yes, that is correct.
How long does that take?
You know, the 5G network's been built right now. It's going to launch in a number of countries within the next quarter. United States, and it's among the first countries to launch that. And you should expect by the end of this calendar year, most metropolitan, areas will be covered by at least more than one operator. And as we get to 2020, I think it's fair to start thinking about nationwide coverage of 5G.
Okay, that's quick.
I'll give you a comparison, which we think is great. At least from a Qualcomm perspective, it's a great proxy why we believe the 5G transition is going to be way faster than some of the skeptics, have been saying about this technology. When we launched 4G, exactly at this time, about a decade ago, when we launched 4G, we had two operators, four devices for the launch of 4G. One of the operators were Verizon.
Right
now, exactly at the time of the 5G launch, a quarter before, we have 20 operators globally, 30 devices. That's
wow.
Significantly larger number than we had with 4G. Shows that we have a mature smartphone market, and the benefits of 5G are going to be well understood by the operators, by device OEMs and the users, and we're optimistic about that.
Okay. So cast forward a little bit to when this is a little more ubiquitous. I feel like it's easy to think about, I'm going to be able to stream Netflix in higher quality more quickly. But my sense with 5G is that in the same way that this happened with 4G and LTE, that all of a sudden there's this sort of this whole new class of things that became possible that just hadn't been before. What's on the list for you with 5G? Like what kinds of things are we going to be able to do, not just faster or better, but that we just didn't do before?
Okay. List is huge.
I would think.
So I'm probably going to need more than a minute.
Okay.
I'll try to be fast.
I have coffee here. I'll drink it while you talk.
Okay. So the first thing you're going to see is all the applications you use today, they become faster. We talk about that. And they become much faster, especially video. But then the full potential of 5G is going to start to get realized when you also make use not only the speed, but the fact that you have speed, latency, and reliability. And I'll walk you through examples over time. So the first example is how you think about social networking. With the fact that you have low latency, you can start thinking about, and the social networking companies we're working with in China and the United States, they talk about social presence. So the whole concept, if you think, for example, of being live or Facebook Live, for example, this is 5G is going to enable that to be in the next level. Not only are you going to have an experience that you look on social media, you take a picture, something you posted, somebody else will go check it, but the ability to see where your friends are in line and online at that moment in time and what they're doing and how you interact with them, that's going to be very different. So next one.
And that's because just to define a point there with latency, just for people who understand, that basically means instead of having like a 2 or 3 or 30 second delay between what you film live and when I see it, you're
no
able
delay.
To pull that number down to actually like effectively zero.
It's basically we're talking in few milliseconds. So basically the concept of being live and broadcast what you're doing becomes a reality, and it's very easy because it's instant. Okay. The next one is a little bit of a mind bender, but that's what I think the real potential of 5G is. So
okay, I'm ready.
All right. So 5G, you can think about a very fast link. And that very fast link not only giving you unlimited data speeds, because you're talking about gigabit speeds and low latency, is give you unlimited storage because you don't have to store anything. Everything's on the cloud. But now you can think of their link as a connection between you and another computer. So, for example, we have a demonstration we show at Qualcomm in our labs that we have a $10,000 gaming PC on one end, a 5G link, and you have a phone on the other end. And then all of a sudden you want to play a gaming PC game that you require $10,000 worth of computing and graphics. You can play on your phone. You do the computation over there, and over the 5G link, you split the rendering. So you can start thinking about having unlimited computing depending on the application. Think about the potential now for you to do completely different things you didn't thought possible with your phone that the application developers will do, because you can get computing on demand, moving the computing to the cloud. And that's going to be very different. is going to be something it's not possible today, as you asked me, and there's going to be applications we haven't seen yet, but it's going to be part of the enterprise and the productivity use cases. It's going to be part of the entertainment and whatever other applications the developers will create. And then I'll go to the very end of the spectrum, what the technology potential is. When you think about all those things we talk about, a high speed, low latency, think about a different device. Think about it like a different device. Think about having an eyeglass when you have, you know, the form factor is not like a VR that I think humans won't walk around the street with a big VR helmet.
Yeah.
But they will use eyeglasses, right? And think about an eyeglass, you have electronics on the side, and then you have like a Black Mirror episode experience that you walk into
but
a
like
room.
In a good way.
You walk into a room through the 5G high speed and latency, you into a lot of machine learning on the device, you look at everybody's face, instant recognition, instant go to the cloud, pull their data out of LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, tell you if you met them, who are they connected with, and give you information about everything. The technology is possible. So that's not that distant future. That's just an example of the potential for 5G for the consumer.
So what's your responsibility as Qualcomm? We're in the middle of this privacy backlash, and I think people are starting to wake up to the idea that giving up this massive amount of data is more complicated than we used to think. And you're sitting here telling me that now it's much easier for me to upload way more data all the time, and that we're going to be able to use these things to connect to each other in new ways. But you're also in a position of making chips that are getting more powerful on the devices themselves to do some of this stuff offline. So, like, where's the balance there that you're talking to people about?
Okay, great question. Maybe I'll start by talking about a role, and then I'll provide my personal opinion
sure.
on this. Maybe not the Qualcomm opinion, maybe okay. my personal opinion. Look, we're the company involved in building the fundamental technology and creating both the products and the intellectual property associated with those big transitions, whether cellular, Wi-Fi, everything radio, everything high-performance, low-power computing. That's what we do, and we provide the platform that many other companies can provide, you know, the end devices and the applications in contact with the end user. So we end up providing the engine, not necessarily we are the company that is getting all this information. The information goes to our engines. But I'll tell you my opinion on this. We live in a connected world. I think maybe in a funny way, I'll say resistance is futile.
Sure.
We're connected. We're connected. Humans we'll end up being connected to each other, and we're going to connect everything, and it's going to be a lot of data. I think what we are seeing right now, and I think it's a very healthy dialogue. It's really healthy dialogue. What we're seeing right now is we had an understanding of what is our physical beings are and how we protect our physical beings. But all of us right now will have also a digital being. And it's a great example about if you look what's happening in other countries like a simple of that will be like your credit scoring. But
sure.
you have a lot of things now part of a digital beings. And maybe, like provided my personal opinion, the society is going to evolve in a way that you just need to be entitled to protections on your digital being like you were in the physical beings. And I think governments is going to evolve in their role of protecting, you know, individual rights and freedom to protect both your physical and digital being. And I think the understanding that we all going to have our digital twin as part of being a connected world, the faster we understand that, I think the faster we find solutions for it.
I don't know if I believe his thing about 5G coming this year, but we'll see about that. Anyway, that's our show, everybody. Thanks to Cristiano, Sam, Christopher, and Joanna for being here. Thanks to Tanya Bustos, our producer, and thank you for listening. We have new episodes on Fridays, so make sure you subscribe to Instant Message on whatever podcast app you use. My favorite one, in case you're wondering, is still Pocket Casts, but only with dark mode turned on. As always, if you have feedback or ideas, email us at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you soon.